everyone. I'm here to tell you about an exciting new Earwolf podcast. It's called Raised by TV. It's hosted by Lauren Lapkus and John Gabris. Lauren and John are going to revisit their favorite TV shows from the 80s and 90s while asking really important questions like, why did so many 90s shows have kids who kept tarantulas as pets? I want to know why so many shows from back then had dead moms. Seems like there was a lot of dead moms back then. They'll even be trying some snacks from their childhood to see how they hold up. Guests like Paul Scheer and Scott Aukerman will even be stopping by in episodes to reenact memorable moments from television. So listen to Raised by TV every Wednesday on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Earwolf.com, or wherever you listen. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Crack Movie Club, the show where we try to make you an expert on your favorite films. Nailed it. That was like the third attempt at me doing this. I kept messing it up today for whatever reason. I'm Tom Ryman. I'm joined today by my guest host, Alex Schmidt.
Hey, it's good to be here.
And also our guest, Katie Golden.
Hello.
Abe is still out. Abe is on a sabbatical. He's off in Tibet searching for a rare blue flower.
I hope he can use it to become Superman.
Yes.
That's the reference, right?
Uh-huh.
Bat Hero?
No, it's Bat Hero.
Oh, yeah.
Hero Bat? Super Bat.
Super Bat.
Strong Bat person.
Yes. We're in the middle of John Hughes month, so we're going to keep that rolling along today with the film Ferris Bueller's Day Off from 1986.
Woo! Woo-hoo!
I'm super excited to have both you guys here today. One, because Alex is our Illinois expert.
This is like, it's like watching a movie that's just the flag of Chicago with like Mike Ditka and the Mayor's Daily dancing in front of it or something. Like, it's so the Chicago suburbs and going to Chicago of my entire youth. It's great. Really, really into it.
And I'm super excited to have Katie here because she's our hilarious social media, timely content person at Cracked.
Yay.
And so it's good to just have her for jokes.
I'm glad you guys let me out of the basement to do this.
Well, you're going right back, so don't be too sunny about it. It seemed a little more aggressive than I anticipated.
Yeah. It's a two-story building. She just calls the first story the basement,
yeah.
And we still don't know why. We all work there.
It's the same floor that we all work
yeah,
on.
Yeah, we all, I don't know.
Before you begin, Katie, can you tell us when the first time you saw this movie was?
Oh, yeah. So I was a little kid, and I went to... My mom was friends with this lady, and her son was crazy and scary. And once he hit my brother with a croquet mallet, so we were over there. And
it's like The Shining. The plot of The Shining.
Fast.
And like he was like starting to tell us about like how dead bodies, when they were in the water for too long, they started to bloat and like disintegrate. And I started crying. So then he put on Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that was the first time I saw it.
Mm. Yeah, that
I saw it because I love Chicago. And when I rewatched it for the show, it's like the fifth time I've seen it. We all come to it differently.
I'm still reeling from Katie's answer.
Yeah.
That is
I had that one locked and loaded.
To answer that question. That's just how you saw every movie.
Well, I went to that same guy's house. Told me more facts about body decomposition, and then we saw 16 Candles.
Yeah, well, I'm also listening to the month of this show and also watching this show, or watching this movie, I realized that this was basically the only John Hughes movie I saw as a kid. Like, I miss the ones you could call girly just because they have female protagonists and female stories. I missed The Breakfast Club until, like, last year. I didn't see it until I was way out of high school, and I was like, oh, I would have appreciated this,
yeah,
you know?
This would have been useful to me.
I still do, but it would have been great. But, yeah, for some reason, and I think mainly because he goes and sees all of my favorite places in the city. And also, it's just really funny and good, I think. I think that's the main reason this was the one Hughes movie I saw a bunch.
It's actually the same for me, I think. Like, all the other ones I saw, like, well into high school, but this is one that I, like, saw repeatedly in, like, throughout middle school and then into high school. So this is, of the films of his we've watched so far, this is the one that was still the freshest in my memory. Like, it wasn't, it'd been a while since I watched it last, but I'd seen it enough that it wasn't, like, going back into 16 Candles and being like, oh, shit, like, this movie is a minefield.
Well, yeah, and also because this movie is not particularly racist or anything, and it's also like relatively clean. It's sort of like Shakespeare or the Bible, where a lot of crazy stuff happens, but there's no cursing and no nudity. You know,
mm-hmm.
Like you can see this as a pretty young kid.
There's a lot of cursing in
on
it.
Paper. Yeah, there's some, but maybe we let that go. I don't know. I am realizing that now.
Oh, and there's also like jokes about rape in it, but you know, when what's her name, Dirty Dancing, is up in her bedroom.
Yeah,
she's like, I don't want to be violated by this
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, you're right. You know what? I take everything back. I guess that stuff just like washed over me when I was a kid. It didn't like bug me that they curse a bit and that she says she has raging chlamydia or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. She's using her herpes, like potentially ward off a sexual predator. She doesn't have herpes. She says she has herpes in an attempt, like on the intercom, she's like, dear intruder, I have so many herpes, you wouldn't want to assault me. Like, that's, and then just, that's, yeah.
There's extra rooms up here for my herpes.
Yeah, and like, as a kid, I was stoked about anything dirty or adult in a movie, but this one, my big takeaways were, like, the Chagall windows at the Art Institute in Chicago. I don't know. I don't know why that all washed over me.
Yeah, I somehow missed that one this time. Maybe I was looking at my phone, I don't know.
Missed what, the windows?
The chlamydia thing.
Oh, yeah.
Herpes.
It's herpes?
I'm pretty sure it's herpes.
It went right by me. Just didn't even register.
Blink and you'll miss those herpes.
Yeah. That's how they get you.
It comes at you fast.
Herpes comes at you fast. Yeah.
Herpes, like life, goes by fast.
That was the original
ending.
Yeah,
that was the original
line.
Thing he said.
Yeah.
Matthew Broderick looks right down the barrel and says, herpes. Gotta stop and look at them.
Well,
because
like,
they go by fast.
We're like touching on the plot. Like, Katie, I feel like, do you want to give us a brief one or two sentence summary of what happens in the movie?
Yeah, so a young Matthew Broderick takes his hypochondriac friend out through Chicago while his, I think he's the school principal, and his sister hunt him down.
That is completely what happens.
It's even just the basic ones kind of crazy because of all the person hunting. It's great.
Yeah.
Love this movie.
Right. It becomes like Red Dragon only for like a high school student. Oh, man. Okay. That's a pretty good sum up. On this show, we like to compare your plot description to a few of our own rudimentary summaries. Katie, feel free to join us in our segment, Terrible Loglines. A convicted sex offender spends all day trying to break into the home of a teenage student.
A young man gridlocks an entire city downtown just to lip-sync battle himself.
A young composer tries to shake up the music industry with his barf concerta.
A popular high school student accidentally thwarts his friend's suicide.
A high school senior hacks a government database with no consequences.
A high school student stares at art real hard.
A man pretends to be catatonic so he can watch his friend's girlfriend undress.
Remember how I said this movie's inoffensive? Oh, great. That plays well now. A lifelong Chicago resident is somehow a Detroit Red Wings fan.
Hijinks ensue after a wacky police department fails to understand that home intruders sometimes leave the scene of the crime.
They do just instantly, like, there's nobody here. You're coming with us. And then they sit her down next to the film's other sexual predator, Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, a lot of crime in this one.
A lot of behind-the-scenes criminals in this movie.
It's like John Hughes' The Wire, you know? Like, it's the city he knows the best, and it's underbelly.
Oh, man. Now that you know the plot of the movie, let's dive into the making of the film from pre-production to post-production in a segment we call Expensive Pretending. Yes.
Before hearing the rest of this month and also prepping this, like, I didn't know how fast John Hughes writes movies.
Yeah.
Like, he can write a movie like the rest of us would, like, get around to filling out some forms for taxes or the government.
Right, yeah, he's, like, doing enrollment for his health plan. Writes a movie. Yeah, he had in the middle of the 80s, he had, 84 was 16 Candles, 85 was Breakfast Club, 86 is Ferris Bueller.
Man, 87
is Pretty in Pink, I think. Which
four-peat.
He didn't direct that one, but he wrote it. So he just...
3.5 Pete.
Yeah. A Hughes Pete. He was just flinging scripts out there. And apparently this was like just a movie that he walked in and barely had a completely formed pitch for. He was just like, it's a kid plays hooky from school, hijinks. It's really all I got. And the producer's like, beautiful. You got to write it real fast because there's a writer strike coming on.
Yeah.
So whereas the other films were maybe just... a question of a budget or production time constraints. He had to crank out the script for Ferris Bueller, which he did in about a week because of a looming writer strike. And you can't begin production on anything once the strike starts, I think is how it goes.
Yeah, something like that.
So yeah, he whipped this miracle out.
Yeah, there's a Vanity Fair article where they John Hughes kept extensive diaries of his entire life. And so they looked at his daily diaries from when he pitched this, and he pitched it February 25th, 1985. And then there's just daily diaries of him writing 15 or 20 pages a day until the script is done March 3rd. And February is a short month. That's like a week. But he just wrote the entire movie. And then it was like, oh, I just completed the three-peat. Anyway, here we go. Let's make it.
He's also writing diaries. How's he find time to do all this? I'm going to write about all the writing I've been doing.
He's like writing a grocery list. He's like, whoops, wrote a movie.
Yeah, he seems like a compulsive writer, which is a really neat quality to have if you can do that and be sane, which it seems like he could.
I don't have the list in front of me, but he has a really extensive list of unproduced screenplays. It's something like maybe 10, maybe as many as 10 or 12 that completed screenplays that just were never produced while he was alive. I mean, they may yet be. I don't know how that would work, but yeah, there's a bunch.
Somebody should grab them or something, right? Or we find out the screenplays were like Transformers 1, Transformers 2, Transformers 3.
Or they're all unspeakably racist.
Who knows? Yeah, and also, because reading about him, it's interesting that he dropped out of college. And he married his high school sweetheart when he was 20 and she was 19, which I feel like kind of that gets written into this movie. Like that they
A little bit.
I'm just worried. Marrying someone so young, you know?
I'm worried about Ferris and Sloan's relationship, though.
Well,
they seem like very superficial people.
Like, I worry about it because I didn't get married at 20 successfully, you know? Like, he's just writing his life. He's like, worked for me, blah, you know? And apparently he dropped out of the University of Arizona and then just went and worked, like, trades, like construction and stuff like that. And in the meantime, wrote, and that got him advertising work and also got him freelance stuff into the National Lampoon. And then he just continued to be cranking out comedy and scripts all of the time. So when National Lampoon got movie deals, he was the guy who was ready to go.
Yeah, he was also, I think we mentioned in an earlier show, he was also writing jokes for comedians at that time. So he was just writing everything.
Yeah, it's so cool.
No piece of paper was safe in a room with John Hughes. He was going to write on that. Or write a whole movie on the back of a napkin.
Who would be mad? That was my clean paper.
This room's filled with movies!
But yeah, I don't know. I'm just always impressed by that because writing a movie is a task and he just, it flows out of him, you know? It's cool.
Yeah, we're all writers in this room, so I think we all appreciate how not usual that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Although on the flip side, you can tell that John Hughes tends to film the first draft of most of his screenplays because I think the first cut of this film is 2 hours and 45 minutes long. So he basically did the script editing in film editing, like in the editing room. And I think they did the same thing with like The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles as well, where he's just like, well, we'll just film this and then we'll cut around it as we need to. And I think that's another reason why he encourages so much improv in his movies.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That can be the second draft, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just start filming it. Yeah, it's draft two. Alex, you want to talk a little bit about the casting?
Yeah. Yeah. According to a few different articles, we're pretty set on Matthew Broderick being Ferris Bueller, but also John Cusack was a big contender. And then you'd found that there's various other sources claiming kind of everybody else was up for it, like Tom Cruise, Michael J. Fox, Jim Carrey at one point.
And Jim Carrey, which is, he's come up in every episode of John Hughes Month. Like, he was really gunning for some John Hughes movies, apparently. During this time.
Like people in the 1980s were like, oh, Jim Carrey is charismatic and funny and pretty handsome. He should just be in every movie possibly. And then he landed in a few of them, and that's what we got.
Yeah. he landed Peggy Sue Got Married and Earth Girls Are Easy. Once bitten.
Nice job, studios. And then also Emilio Estevez got offered the role of Cameron, and he turned it down.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then Matthew Broderick was friends with Alan Ruck in real life, who was older than him and is pretty old to be playing a high school
considerably
student.
Considerably. I was shocked when I found out how old he was.
He's 29.
That's right.
Yeah.
30-year-old man.
Yeah, yeah.
Hello, high school peers.
Yeah. I always think of that 30 Rock joke with Steve Buscemi where he's got a shirt that says like rock band on it.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, fellow teens, you know?
Yeah, with a skateboard.
But Alan Ruck totally plays in this. Like, he seems like a tall guy who's in high school.
Oh, he's great.
It's great.
I think he's probably the best performance, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was, I mean, I think he stole the show, even though Broderick was super charismatic in it, which is quite a feat because he kind of was in the background for most of it.
Yeah, they're kind of the three main characters, and I feel like he gets to be a main character because his performance is so good, more than anybody else.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, he earns his way in.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were in a Broadway show together.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, and I think actually he played, and more recently he played the role of Leo Bloom in The Producers, which Matthew Broderick also plays. So I think maybe they're still friends.
Yeah, that checks out.
I hope so.
I had read that they worked together on a production of Biloxi Blues, and the voice that Alan Ruck does for Mr. Peterson in the movie is an impression of that production's director.
It's a great voice.
It's a pretty great voice. Yeah. Watching him do it is fun too, because his face, it's all
daughter.
Yeah. Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, his jaw's like clenched and then sometimes it opens like a snake. Like, it's great.
Yeah.
Like, it's really good.
And he's like trying to get back in character after Ferris is distracting him. He's like, I'm so mad.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie really benefits from being pre-email, because there's a lot of things have to be transacted over the phone, and so there's all kinds of phone hijinks. It's great.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And also from the lack of cell phones.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the landline era, kids. It was the best.
You could just have like a Rube Goldberg machine of like recorded messages that keeps the evil principal off his tail, and that was a real fun part.
Yeah, all the different fake answering machine. Oh, man.
Yeah, it's Joker like elaborate,
right?
And also just a plot that somehow works out, even though, come on,
yeah, very archaic, like mousetrap, like a 1980s technology mousetrap.
You like trip a wire and then a barf sound plays as like a CPR dummy like rises from the bed.
Yeah, like partially.
Yeah. Yeah, that I love your bad log line about like a barf concerto, because also that's just amazing phrasing. But like him having a keyboard, because I had a little electronic keyboard that I practiced piano on as a kid, and seeing him have it rigged up to play barf and cough and puke sounds, I was like, there's a lot I need to learn. There's a lot of tech
he had to
out.
Put a 5x7, like one of those ancient floppy disks into the, like it had a drive for that. So I'm assuming like all the sound, like he just put in a different disk for different sounds. And that was like his barf sounds.
I mean, like he was sort of portrayed as a slacker, but goddamn, he earned it. Like he was working hard.
He's a brilliant slacker.
Yeah.
He put more effort into all of his schemes than he would have had to do at school. Like all the learning how to somehow hack pre-internet. It's like,
I assume he took all that experience from War Games. Well, hacking into the school's computer to change my absences will be a piece of cake.
The Matthew Broderick unified movie theater.
Yeah. Yeah, all Matthew Broderick films take place within the same universe.
The Brodyverse.
Yeah. It starts with glory.
Well, also, we should talk about the three main characters. Sloan Peterson is played by Mia Sara. Apparently, John Hughes wanted like an older actress for the role, and Mia Sara auditioned, and he was like, "Perfect, you're cast." And then found out she's 18. Like,
how did he not know that she was 18? I mean, she's really good in the movie, but it's like she's also clearly a teenager.
Yeah, well, she has like a definite maturity to her, but is also so young.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which is perfect for the movie, and it works great. But come on, John.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Well, apparently Molly Ringwald really wanted to play that role. But according to her, an interview with Molly Ringwald that I saw, John Hughes told her, "No, you don't want this role. The part's not big enough for you," which is interesting.
And it is kind of the third character.
Yeah.
Like, I as much as Alan Ruck earns being the other main character of the movie, it's also really written toward Ferris and Cameron. Like,
yeah, she's just sort of there to witness and participate in some of the hijinks, but
yeah,
really she's just kind of there for most of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. There's also a thing I was very pleased to find out, which is that the actors who are Ferris's parents, Cindy Pickett and Lyman Ward, they met on the set of the movie, fell in love, got married, and had two kids.
Aww.
They ended up divorcing in 1992, shortly after again playing parents, this time in the movie Sleepwalkers, a Stephen King adaptation.
It's a real roller coaster ride, Alex.
Yeah.
I'm devastated.
Warned everyone, because that's really meaningful to me. The whole thing, like, what a story. You know?
Katie's going to be the only person who sits through Sleepwalkers and just weeps.
Their love died on the vine.
Yeah, but you're like every other movie ever where it's teens and just some actors or the side character parents, like, they never get together like that. That's amazing. So great.
You pointed out that Louis Anderson is the flower delivery man, which is great. Like, I never
spotted
that.
If people don't totally remember the movie, there's a bit where there are just things being delivered to the house because the whole community is backing Ferris like he's a charity or something. And the guy who drops off the flowers that Jeannie receives, his sister, when she's home, is the comedian Louis Anderson. And then there's another joke moment where she thinks the police have come, but it's actually like a sexy nurse telegram. And there's like three or four other service employees around her. And so just Louis Anderson's in the middle of the frame, like nodding along with a sex nurse poem. It's fascinating.
Also, to further undermine Alex's testimony that this movie is pure, the nurse has this line where she's like, you know, something, something, we wish you luck because I'm the nurse who likes to. And then the door slams in her face.
And they slam the door. They don't say it.
Yep.
They don't say it.
Mm.
We all say it at home, but they don't say it. This movie's innocent. No, it's not. There's a lot of stuff, but it's great. There's also, with other kind of small role people, there's Ben Stein is famous for being one of the teachers in the movie. Like, he does the Bueller.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one other teacher in it, which is Sloane's English teacher. And you just see him being very boring about prison.
Talking about prison
in the novel before she gets called out of class. And that teacher is played by Del Close. And if people don't know improv or sort of comedy of the late 20th century, like, Del Close kind of, he's like the George Washington for long form improv and for Improv Olympic, UCB, where like most working actor comedians come from, is Del Close's work in Chicago. And he just pops up in the movie, which makes it even more of a Chicago movie. It's very exciting.
He does a really great bit with what he has.
He's good.
He starts to draw bars across the word prison. It's the dumbest thing.
So silly.
It's so funny.
And I'd completely forgotten about it until I rewatched it. Like, you just remember all of Ben Stein stuff.
Yeah.
Bueller, and then also his talk about the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which I read that John Hughes told him to just improvise about something he knew about, and Ben Stein was like a Republican presidential speechwriter, so he was like, oh, supply-side economics.
He starts teaching the kids about Reaganomics.
Like, he's teaching everything he believes. It's great.
He's like, it rhymes with schmoodoo economics, okay? It's voodoo economics.
Yeah, but Del Close is crushing it, too. Yeah, he founded Improv Olympic in Chicago, and there's like a cool legend around him where when he died, he donated his skull to the theater. So it's sort of a like Yorick from Hamlet kind of thing. Like, his skull is around.
Oh.
You can't go visit it. I think it's in a back room somewhere. But yeah.
That's
He's
haunting.
Really intense about improv. Yeah, loves it.
Yeah. Use my skull in all of your bits.
Debride the dead skin from my skull and put it in your attic.
Yes, and, you know, like, improv game. Let's do it.
They have to use the skull in every single improv show they do.
Play with my remains.
We have to mention Jeffrey Jones.
Yeah, we do. He's probably, other than the three main kids, the other biggest character in the movie.
And he's great.
He's Rooney, the principal.
It's a really solid performance.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a funny man, but he's got some legal troubles for listeners that maybe don't know.
Isn't it like child pornography or something?
Yes, yeah.
I can say that, right?
Yes, I think so. I'm sure. Yeah, we don't need a tap dance around it. No, it's a matter of record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very sad. But he's very good in the film.
Yeah. And his character was based on John Hughes' old high school vice principal. So Hughes actually took Jeffrey Jones to meet this guy to like learn about his character. So I thought that was an interesting tidbit.
Yeah, he and, well, also Edie McClurg is his secretary in the school secretary is amazing. They're both great.
Yeah.
Like there's just a whole comedy team going on within the movie of them. It's really
good. This part that just happens in the background where she's pulling pencil after pencil out of her hair.
Yeah.
It's like so funny, and it's just like happening in the background.
She is. She's just doing business. Like, she's not. She's not.
And a lot of characters have said like that. Like when you're talking about Hughes encouraging improv, it's probably a good side benefit of that. Like Del Close is like, great, prison bars over the word prison. Yeah. And she's like, I keep pencils in my hair and I say wastoids in a perfect way. It's great. Yeah.
And then, of course, she shows up again in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which we'll get to on a later episode.
Yeah, coming soon.
Some notable crew members on the team is the director of photography is Tak Fujimoto, who went on to film... be a cinematographer on a lot of pretty cool films like Silence of the Lambs, Philadelphia, The Sixth Sense, Signs, Grumpier Old Men, and That Thing You Do.
Is that a sequel to Grumpy Old Men?
It sure is.
Okay.
That's a lot of range. It's really cool.
Yeah.
When he makes, I apologize if I'm talking about Chicago too much. He makes it look very romantic in this movie. He makes it look like a real destination and a real place to journey to. And it's really cool.
Yeah. Interestingly, like in some of the in Siskel and Ebert's review for this film, Roger Ebert thought it was great. Gene Siskel was irritated by how lovingly it portrayed Chicago. It's really funny.
That's probably fair.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of it. Well, there's an interview with Hughes where he says that the Art Institute sequence, which if you don't know, it's just where they're in the art museum, and he said that was probably self-indulgent, and it was just to point out a lot of the art that he really likes. Like, there's symbolic meaning to it, and it works, too. But, like, he spends a lot of time on just, like, how cool the Seurat painting is, because it is. Go see it.
It is, yeah. And I think it's actually narratively important, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
And the other one I wanted to point out was Ira Newborn, again, returned to do the score, and the orchestrator of the movie was Alf Clausen. And if you don't recognize that name, he is the composer for The Simpsons.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the critic, so.
Isn't he, like, really insistent on making new compositions for episodes of The Simpsons? Like, not just reusing a bunch of stuff?
I don't know. I haven't heard that, but.
I think he might actually be on his way out, unfortunately, from The Simpsons.
Oh, not from life.
No.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. God, no. I'm sorry.
He was like, well, if I have anything to say about it.
Yeah. He might have an unfortunate accident. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the production. Alex, you've got some notes here.
Yeah, so Chicago suburbs, folks. Here we go. John Hughes. I learned in prepping this, which is really neat, that John Hughes, his initial early years were in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is outside Detroit. And so he grew up a Red Wings fan, and that's why Cameron wears a Red Wings jersey the whole movie. So people who care about hockey, now you know. But he moved to Northbrook, Illinois in 1962, which is in Cook County. That's the county Chicago's in, but it's outside of the city. It's kind of northwest of it. And Northbrook is, it used to be called Shermerville, which is why he made Northbrook Shermer in all those movies. But he used his alma mater, Glenbrook North High School, for the exteriors of the high school in the movie. And then he used a recently closed high school in Des Plaines called Maine North that is the interiors of the movie. And I believe he did that in The Breakfast Club as well.
Yep, because they were filming them at the same time.
Yeah.
Because Johnny H. gets shit done.
Yeah. I can only imagine him moving very rapidly at all times. Like typing, typing, running, running.
Yeah.
Like, directing, directing. Like,
he has the heart rate of a hummingbird.
Yeah.
He real fleet of foot. Attack.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I didn't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's all right.
But not at like a hummingbird lifespan.
No,
he didn't live
true.
Like I 2 weeks.
He lived for many more years.
Yeah, yeah. It's
I
fine.
Didn't mean it. Oh man, this is I'm two for two and just like dead people.
Well, you know, it's because you have an unbreakable association with dead bodies in this film.
That's true. I was traumatized.
That's But
he grew up and I grew up at like the same distance from downtown Chicago. So it really speaks to me the whole like, oh, you live in this separate town and suburb, but also there's this journey, you know, and it really, really plays in the movie. And they shot it in those places. That's where they did it.
Yeah, I think the only stuff that's not in the Chicago suburbs is Ferris's house, which is in California.
Ah, that makes sense. But, it's pretty green. Yeah.
I think the rest of it is all Chicago.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, I saw a quote where Hughes called this film his love letter to Chicago. And it's kind of it's a real barbed quote. He says, quote, "It's funny. Nobody ever says anything to Woody Allen about always filming in New York. America has this great reverence for New York. I look at it as this decaying horror pit. So let the people in Chicago enjoy Ferris Bueller." All right, man.
Yeah. Well, reading about his growing interest in the National Lampoon, he had an advertising job in Chicago at a couple different firms. And the last one he worked at, his boss gave him permission to, like, do Lampoon stuff in his own time. But Lampoon's office was in New York, and he would take trips to New York just to hang out there in person with them. And he would also occasionally take a day trip just to and from New York without telling work, just not tell anyone that he had left for the day, but he would leave a full cup of coffee on his desk to make it look like he had just stepped away when he was actually flying to New York City to work with them. But at the same time, he had so much distaste for New York, he didn't just, like, move there. He, like, kept living in Chicago and doing these, like, weird New York trips.
That make... Oh, man. Yeah. We'll get into that in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because that makes that movie make more sense.
I think he, like, hates New York.
Well, like, in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Steve Martin's character works in New York but lives in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's based really on that strange. Move. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just writing about what he knows. That's why he can write so fast. He's like, oh, let's see. I got married at 19 and I moved from, you know.
And I also own a cool sweater vest and leather jacket combo.
The main character's name is Blonde Blues.
Ron Blues.
Ron Blues. I would watch a movie about Ron Blues. Sounds like a fun guy.
Don Shoes. Cameron's house is actually a pretty famous house. It's called the Ben Rose House. It's in Highland Park, Illinois. For the scene where they drive the Ferrari through the glass, they actually drove a Ferrari replica through the glass of that house.
Rad.
They had to bring one of the original architects in to reinforce the other walls of the house because you notice the entire wall is glass. So they did that so when they drove a car through the paint, the whole house wouldn't fall down. and then once they did it, the owner of the house, who at the time was Ben Rose, who I think was a photographer, said, "Okay, you owe me $25,000. So Johnny just was like, "All right, here you go."
He was like, "Paramount owes you $25,000. I will sprint to my next movie."
Yes. On to Pretty in Pink.
I wrote it in an hour. No,
so. You might have. I don't know.
It's just writing the check for $25,000 and wrote, like, in the notes, another movie.
Yeah. There's another script on the back of the check. As I mentioned, the Ferraris is a replica. It's not an actual Ferrari. They use several replicas. I think three different ones are the ones you see in the movie, except for the insert shots, and those are, like, the close-up shots. It's the only time they use one of those real Ferraris because they are super rare and super expensive.
Wow.
I think I read, this may not be correct, but I think I had read that it's that specific type of Ferrari is the most expensive car that's ever been sold. I think one was sold at auction for, like, $10 million. Somebody will have to double check me on that one, but yeah, so they weren't going to, like, nobody was going to let them use one of those cars for this movie. So they had to
go flying over them.
I know there's inflation and stuff, but isn't that more money than it costs to make the movie?
Yes.
Like the whole film?
Yes, the movie had a budget of $6.5 or somewhere in the area of $6 million. So yeah, one of those cars sold for more than the film cost to produce.
Yeah, that guy could have made like 1.5 Ferris Bueller's. Why'd he buy that car? Hot tip.
Well, I think at the time it was worth considerably less, but
sure, yeah.
Also, they sing Donkashane a bunch of times in the movie because it's John Hughes' least favorite song in the entire world.
I was very disappointed to learn that, but that's fine.
Only reason he put it in there. The release of the film, the poster game is much improved. You guys can check out the poster for Ferris Bueller. It's much more concise than The Breakfast Club or 16 Candles. It actually has a tagline that makes sense.
sounds important.
Yeah. His other posters had, like, novels written at the top of them. Again, because he can't stop writing.
Right. They gave him the draft, and he was like, scribble on the draft.
Furiously. On the prints of the poster.
Well, the tagline Leisure Rules?
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
unlike the 16 Candles of Breakfast Club ones, which are like 7 different taglines and they're all dumb.
Yeah, this one's like, what, 11, 12 letters? Mm-hmm. Great. Real tight.
Real economic. Smart use of space. Yeah, so we mentioned the film had a budget of around $6 million. I've seen 5.8, so around $6 million. Grossed $70 million. It was the number 10 top grossing film of 1986.
It's like 7 Ferraris.
Yeah. So many Ferraris. They could have thrown one real Ferrari off a mountain for this movie. If they had but known the amount of money that the film would make. And Matthew Broderick says that he and John Hughes briefly discussed making a sequel where Ferris was in college, but ultimately decided against it because Matthew Broderick has an interesting quote here that I will simply repeat to you. He said, "The movie is about a singular time in your life. In some way, it doesn't have a sequel. It's a little moment, and it's a lightning flash in your life. It's a time you don't keep." Which makes sense.
Yeah, that's fair.
Because everything in the film, it's presented that way, too. Like, Ferris seems very aware that he's probably not going to be friends with Cameron much longer because they're going to go to different schools, and he's worried about what's going to happen with his relationship with Sloan because she has another year in high school. And he's, you know, the thing he says, you know, life moves pretty fast. So you got to stop and enjoy it before it changes because it's going to.
Yeah, that's all super right. And also, like, I think there's a belief out there among some people that Ferris Bueller is very, very annoying in this movie. Like, he's a very annoying character. And I don't think he is. But if there was a second movie, I could maybe see that becoming more pronounced.
Him being older, I think, would hurt it. I think he toes the line, sort of like...
I think he's great. Yeah. I think he makes it work.
It's made ambiguous how self-serving he is versus altruistic.
That's true, yeah.
Because, like, everything he does, it does seem to be for the sake of Cameron, but it could also, like, it's almost like he's sort of acting as if it's for himself, but really it does seem to be for Cameron. Like, Cameron's the one who benefits the most from everything that happens. But he does. Yeah. He's also like, well, you know, but I like driving Ferraris, right. So that's why. But I think it's, I don't know, it's made very ambiguous. It's very makes it interesting.
Yeah, that's a good call. I think I agree. His reason on the face of it of I'm trying to make Cameron happier, I think it checks out. I think he means it. It just, there's all these side benefits that he's really excited about. But
He's also super indulging himself.
Yeah, he's trying to, I think, make himself happier too, especially with like life looming, you know. But I think it checks out and he's great. Pro Ferris. Pro Chicago. I'm a real homer this one.
Oh, you had something about the Oh Yeah song. Do you want to say that real quick?
So speaking of dollars, I think everybody knows that song that this movie made famous and is like in other stuff that basically wants to reference this movie or this time, where it's that Oh Yeah song, which we'll play a clip of or something, maybe. I don't want to do an impression of it. But it's a song by a Swiss musical duo named Yellow. And I looked into one of the guys in the band, his name, Dieter Meyer. And Dieter, for one thing, says he's never seen this movie.
I've never seen this movie.
It's like an hour and a half, man. Sit down with it, you know? But also, he made several million dollars off of the royalties from the movie and then also other places using the song. And then in life, he didn't just like sit on that money or waste it like a rock star or something. He like reinvested it in a bunch of companies, like chocolate companies and a winery and stuff. And he now has a net worth of $175 million. For being half of the band that's like,
won't watch the movie? No, I won't watch
it. Yeah,
this.
Not going to bother.
I'm going to make millions on my chocolate and wine.
Yeah, Swiss efficiency. It's great. Yeah.
Swiss
like John Shoes, Ron Shoes has to keep running from movie to movie, and Dieter Meyer just has to keep running from business to business. They're all on the move.
It's all a front for their money laundering.
Exposed on this show.
Well, that's how the movie was made. Now let's get into some observations, starting with some stuff you might not have noticed in a segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things. I had a weird thing in my throat. That came out really weird. So I apologize.
No, it's perfect. It's perfect.
He meant to just say secret things.
Secret things.
Yeah, secret. That was it. Alex, you want to start us off?
This is a real quick one. You probably have to have seen the movie recently, remember, but in general, there's that very fancy restaurant where Ferris claims to be Abe Froman, and he gets into it. You probably don't remember that the sign on it says that the name of it is Shea Keys, which, as you hear me say, you realize, oh, that's like a fake French version of Shakey's, like the pizza parlor. That is just a very down-to-earth fun place versus this like snooty place where the guy tells him he's not the Sausage King of Chicago. Just a fun little bit.
I didn't get that for the longest time growing up because there are no Shakey's where I grew up.
Yeah, I think it's like mostly a West Coast thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how I had heard of it earlier. But yeah, I didn't know until researching this that like, oh, that's just a fun Easter egg. Like in his week of writing the script, he did that bit. Great.
I'm just now finding out about Shakey's, so I don't know how I missed the Shakey's boat.
Yeah. It's like if you folks at home don't know it, it's like a birthday pizza place. Like they have a sign out front where you get your name on it and it's like for big group birthday pizza. Like it's a good time.
I'm going to go to Shakey's for my birthday.
Brett's shaking his head.
Don't do that. He's like, no, don't do that.
Recently, it's not very good.
Oh, actually, I know how
Shakey's
I've heard of it.
Shakey's did not hold up. It held up like 16 candles.
I know how I've heard of it. There's a Steve Martin bit where he references Shakey's. A stand-up bit. And he's from California, so he knew about it. Yeah. But he makes it sound like a birthday pizza place. And so then I was like, ah, I get it. Great. Much more crucial Easter egg. I rewatched this movie with like an Amazon thing, and there's an Amazon X-ray thing. And they picked out that there's an inside story documentary about the movie, which says that Charlie Sheen's character was going to be a whole thing. There was like a lot to that character of Charlie Sheen. In the movie, he's just in the police station and he meets Jeannie and they have a conversation in a moment. But his name was Garth Volbeck was the character. And there was going to be a whole backstory where like he was part of Ferris's earlier life and like an earlier friend of Ferris. And Ferris tried to set Garth on a good path, but it didn't work out. And then Garth got into like crime and drugs and violence, you know. And so then Ferris is motivated by like, I got to save my next friend and not let the Garth thing happen to him. And so the whole movie would be based on this like guilt over Charlie Sheen going astray.
But he's not still friends with him.
Right.
So he abandoned Garth.
Yeah, so also Ferris is not necessarily the best. And I was thinking, too, knowing that Emilio Estevez was almost Cameron, then it would have been a movie of Ferris is trying to save the guy who is genetically closest related to Charlie Sheen, Emilio Estevez, because the Charlie Sheen thing didn't work out. Like, he found a new friend who looks like the old friend, but it's like a substitution thing. You know, it would have been crazy.
Trying to save him from turning into his brother.
Yeah.
No, you mustn't make Hot Shots. Make the Mighty Ducks.
He's an agent, yeah.
We'll get you a cool cameo in Mission Impossible.
Yeah, well, I'm curious how much, if any, they shot that stuff, because Tom, when you said the original cut was much longer, maybe they like shot a lot of that.
They might have,
maybe,
yeah.
Charlie Sheen was on set quite a bit.
Inhabiting Garth. He apparently deprived himself of sleep for 48 hours to prepare for that role. Also, I'm not sure why Ferris / agent became a vampire in the sketch I was just doing, but...
It's a cinematic universe, man.
It's part of Universal's dark universe.
Ferris Bueller. A Tom Cruise mummy gets taken around the city by Ferris Bueller to feel better.
Katie just leaned away. Nobody can see that. As soon as I said that, just like...
Too good of an idea.
Some of the license plates, like Ferris's parents' license plates, are Vacation and Mr. Mom in the movie, which I thought was neat.
Yeah.
Because those are old John Hughes movies.
The Ferrari license is nervous.
Yeah.
Sure is.
That really stuck out to me this time, too.
Yeah. I mean, like... I guess it's symbolic that Cameron is nervous about the car.
Yeah. Or like Cameron's dad is really, really self-aware or something. He's like, obviously, I'll be nervous about this car the rest of my life. Let's get this vanity plate.
He knows enough to identify that he has a problem, but not enough to actually do anything about it.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I'll just put the vanity plate on there.
But it's like, because there's a surprising amount of that Easter eggy stuff for this being a teen comedy.
Right.
It's like pretty straightforward, you know?
Yeah, I think this was John Hughes like riding on a super high. Like he was feeling himself on every possible level. So
yeah.
It's just like, I'm going to be as self-referential as possible, short of inserting a weird, sweaty cameo of himself like Shyamalan does. Alex, you had some thoughts about The Graduate?
Yeah. If we want to get into like, oh, what's the true meaning of this movie?
Yeah. Let's tell me what this movie's really about.
I don't know who's seen The Graduate, but it's a great movie. And also it's about a lot of the things this movie's about. Like, I think this movie, on rewatching it, even after rewatching it a lot, I think it's both very funny and also very meaningful. Like, they really earn a lot of the themes and the questions of, like, what do I do after high school? What do I do with my life? What is the meaning of life? What should I be doing? And I, watching it this time now, a little bit older, I was like, oh, this movie's kind of The Graduate plus fun teen comedy John Hughes stuff. Like, it even, in a sense, ends with an adult character riding away on a school bus by accident, because you have the credit after the during the credits comedy scene of Rooney just getting the next school bus he can after he's been beaten for his crimes
and mauled by a dog for his crimes. For his crimes.
Yeah. And it's like, it's, that's interesting to me, because, like, is translating The Graduate to teenagers and Chicago diehards a good thing? And I, is it bad? Is it weird? Like, because that movie is so tangibly heavy, and this kind of lightens that, but I think it still keeps all the meaning at the same time. I think it works, you know?
Yeah, I think they dilute it with the Ferris character.
Yeah, like Dustin
Cameron
Hoffman
more embodies what
the
conflict of The Graduate that Dustin Hoffman's having.
Yeah, yeah, Cameron's very Dustin Hoffman-y, but also, like, wackier about it too,
right? Yeah,
he's like, he's in bed singing about Egypt land. Dustin Hoffman,
my Cameron go,
which is super weird.
Yeah.
Also, just tangent, favorite weird joke in the movie is toward the very end, Jeannie gets back and the mom is complaining to the dad about Jeannie did this and that and blew the deal, and the dad's just like, I think we should shoot him. Amazing.
I love it because, like, throughout the whole movie, I felt so bad for Jeannie. I think, like whoever watches that movie and doesn't just feel the most sympathy for Jeannie, like, I don't know what's going on, because, like, she is much better at behaving than Ferris, and she's always the one that gets in trouble. Ferris never gets in trouble. He's the golden child, and she's like, basically, she's like, you know, Ferris has never done anything to me. It's just he is perfect, gets everything handed to him on a silver platter, and I get threatened with being shot by my own father.
Yeah, it's a really perfect, like, she's just existentially mad at him. Like, the fact that he exists and gets to exist this way.
Yeah, she resents him. Yeah.
Is offensive to her.
Yeah. Yeah. And next to Cameron, she's the other character in this movie that actually has, like, an arc.
Yeah.
Because she sort of, I don't even know why it happens, but, like, she just decides, I'm not going to be mad at Ferris anymore. I guess because she's more mad at Rooney for breaking into her house.
I mean, it's weird because, like, for some reason, I watched this last night, and I couldn't get this idea that Ferris Bueller is Jesus, like, out of my head.
Speak on that.
Okay. so, like, I don't know. So I'm not particularly that religious, so I don't have an agenda here, but I kept noticing, like, religious imagery, like, well, okay, so Cameron sings this weird Egypt song, which is, you know, it's the thing with Moses, like, telling the Pharaoh to let my people go, and he's like, let my Cameron go, and he's singing this in reference to Ferris calling him and trying to get him out of his bed, and before he, like, leaves and goes with Ferris, he, like, crosses himself, and, you know, all of that, you could say all of these are just sort of, like, throwaway jokes, but there's a bunch of them. Like, he, like, has that, like, save Ferris sign on the water tower, which is very similar to the Jesus saves things you see on water towers or on, you know, barn silos, where it's just like a random Jesus saves
whole
sign.
Billboards. Yeah.
And then if you kind of go into it a little deeper, it's like Ferris Bueller is the only one who breaks the fourth wall. Everything goes right for him. He's clearly like a god because he knows he's in a movie and he's got like omniscient knowledge of the movie. He knows what Cameron's going to do before he does it. He heals Cameron's mysterious illness, like Jesus, and he can hack before there's internet. So, like, you know, he knew about the internet.
Whoa.
Before the, like, this movie was made in 1986. Right?
Because if people don't remember, what we've been referencing is, like, Rooney is looking at Ferris's attendance record, and then Ferris changes it from Ferris's home computer.
Right,
Yeah. Yeah, he hacks in and edits it. I forgot there's not really internet yet.
There's no internet yet, right? Like, it came out in the 90s.
There was like a basic defense industry version. Yeah.
There's some version of it, but yeah, it wasn't, I don't think it was something that normal people could access.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, that's, whoa.
Yeah.
Spooky.
Spooky. and also, like, he's uniting everyone in high school. Like, the lady, the poofy hair, pencil mm-hmm. hair lady, is like, oh, yeah, no, everyone likes him. And he's, like, uniting all of these sects of high
schoolers. He's a righteous dude.
He's a righteous dude, like a righteous god. and then... Also, everyone who has faith in him is rewarded, and everyone who does not have faith in him, like his sister and the principal, endure mass suffering.
Much punishment.
The principal is an empiricist, and he requires the body of evidence. He literally asks for Cameron to produce a body when Cameron's impersonating
oh my God.
The girlfriend's father. Yep. He's like, where's the body? And then he's punished for that because, like, it's not about empiricism. It's about faith in Ferris Jesus.
Yeah, what causes him to release that empiricism? Like, you know, I don't need to see the evidence anymore, is when he hears Ferris's voice. When he hears the voice of God.
The voice of God. Yeah, exactly. also, I think that, like, you know, if I'm going to extend this to its furthest possible place, like, the principal is Satan because he's, like, saying Bible verses to Sloan, and he's, like... Yeah. But he's very insincere about it. He's only saying it because he's just, like, screwed up and he thinks he's insulted her father. And she, like, pretends like she, like, is impressed by it. But she's not because, like, she's dating Jesus. I don't know. It's pretty convinced on this. I don't think you can change my mind that Ferris is not Jesus.
Dating Jesus. CBS this fall.
I'd watch Dating Jesus.
Yeah, of course.
That's an incredible theory.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
It all checks out across the board in pretty much every way. And it's really great.
I just wanted to talk about how the movie is absolutely about Cameron, which we've already sort of discussed.
Yeah.
But, like, I want to talk about the scene in the art museum. So when they go there at first, like, the three of them, they're all just kind of looking at art, you know, not really taking it very seriously. Like, they do the silly pose in front of the one statue that has its arms crossed. And then it gets that section where it keeps cutting back and forth between Ferris and Sloan and Cameron. And Ferris and Sloan are sitting in front of some piece of art.
It's the blue. It's called America Windows. It's by Marc Chagall. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
And it's one of the best things at the Art Institute. Yeah.
They're not paying any attention to it, though, because they're totally wrapped up in each other and they're just focused on each other. So totally into themselves.
Yeah.
Then it keeps cutting back to Cameron, who is just staring at the painting. In particular, he's staring at the little boy in the painting, or the child in the painting, who's standing alone with his or her mother.
Yeah. Cause, well, that painting is A Sunday on La Grande Jatte by Georges Seurat.
So,
when I art nerd about it because it's also a pointillist painting, which is where you do a bunch of little dots mm-hmm. to paint the entire painting. And so he sees it on a scale of dots. Like as they
as it goes closer and closer
in the painting,
in.
You see the dots. You get there.
Yeah, where it sort of loses its identity as the figure that it's supposed to be and just becomes just this sea of color.
Yeah.
So, like, just all the things that make it up. So he's staring at this kid who sort of looks like he's just screaming. Just mutely screaming for all eternity. There's no father. It's just the kid and the mother. And the more he stares at it, like you said, the closer it gets in, the less it looks like a person. And you just see all the little bits that make it up. And, like, that's like Cameron's, like, moment of realization. Like, that's like when he has kind of the beginning of a breakthrough, I guess, in the learning about himself.
Yeah.
Because he's the only one in the movie that learns anything about himself. And I think this is the scene where we show that, where we see that that happens to him and that it specifically does not happen to Ferris or Sloan because they're superficial. They're wrapped up in each other and they're not paying attention to the things that are going around. And it's sort of echoed by Cameron gaining this big insight and then Ferris being like, well, we're not even going to be friends anymore after this. And, like, he's just thinking about his gratification from moment to moment, whereas Cameron's like, oh, I'm trying to gain this insight. And then we get a sort of, we hear him talk about that a little bit in the parade scene afterwards, where he's like, I don't know what I'm going to do in college. And Sloan asks him, well, what are you interested in? He says, nothing. But he's not like, he kind of is not glib, but he's sort of like almost proud of it. Like he's proud of himself for saying that. So that's where we see the insight that he's, part of the insight that he's gained into himself is that it's okay to not know what he wants to do.
Yeah, it's not that he's a nihilist or something. It's that he's understood himself better.
Right.
Yeah.
He's also not been allowed to develop a personality away from his father. Like, his dad is clearly very controlling. He's in, like, this glass enclosure, like a zoo animal. And, you know, his dad loves the car more than he loves Cameron.
And Ferris specifically says that Cameron's house is like a museum.
Yes. Yeah, Cameron is the art.
Is the little boy in the museum.
He is the art.
Yeah, they even, because even in that sequence a little before it, there's that big Rodin statue of, I think it's Balzac. It's a large fat man being like, ah. And then all three of them kind of do a pose in front of it like, ah, like they become that statue. Mm-hmm. And then a little bit later on, they become that painting.
Yeah.
But just Cameron.
And I think that theme of like, if you are art, you're not allowed to mess up or be a mistake or be not pristine. And so Cameron is like this like hermetically sealed kid who isn't allowed to just screw up.
You can't exist on your own terms. You have to exist within the perceptions of everyone else.
Right.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And Christ shows him the way.
And that painting that Ferris and his girlfriend are making out in front of is very religious.
There's stained glass windows, but it's all about like America's diversity and freedom, and in particular religious freedom.
Yes.
Okay, now we're going to segue into a segment that talks about scenes that would have enhanced or ruined the plot that we like to call bonus scenes that should have existed. Katie, do you have anything for this?
The dad shoots the sister. It's like, well, taking you out to the side of the barn.
What a turn that would be. Oh, no.
Or just the dad, like, cocking the gun, like, menacingly after the ending credits.
Yeah. We just see him cleaning it and loading it. Well, oh, yeah. Speaking of fratricide, Cameron's dad's absolutely going to murder him, right? Like, there's no way that confrontation does not end in one of them or both of them being murdered.
That's one of the best arguments for the side of Ferris's bad friend and is destroying his friend's life or something like that. Because, yeah, it doesn't seem like... Like, that conflict will probably just end in a lot of yelling and fighting and screaming, but it could also end, it, like, horribly.
Murder, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, like... any guy who, like, lives in a literal glass house and is, like, okay with being nude, I guess, in front of everyone to see you, gotta be a serial killer. A rich serial killer who can get away with it. So, yeah, Cameron does not survive this. There's no way.
There were bones all along the inside of that Ferrari.
Now it's a Dark Universe movie. Here
we yeah, baby! Johnny Depp, Invisible Man!
Well, I in trying to think of bonus scenes, this movie kind of covers a lot of the good ideas, too. This is one of the rare movies where, like, wouldn't it be a funny bonus scene of seeing bedraggled, beaten, bitten on Rooney working his way back to the school in his car or whatever. And then you see it. It's over the credits. There's a really, really fun scene of him getting on the bus and being offered gummy bears that are warm because they were in the girl's pocket. And, you know, you get it. Like, you get to see the dad trying to work in downtown Chicago with the huge crazy parade going on.
Yeah.
It's a funny bonus scene. Like, oh, the effects of this parade on office workers in town. Like, it's a good time, you know?
I want to see Tom Bueller go to some therapist and be like, I keep seeing my son everywhere. I don't know what this means.
I've seen my son 5 times today, but... And also, I think his girlfriend hit on me.
Yeah.
I don't understand why I would see that.
He had met his girlfriend before.
He has to have known who she is, right?
They're very vague about, at least the administrative people, because Edie McClurg, the book on her is she knows about everybody. And Rooney's like, Edie McClurg, who's Ferris dating? And she's like, oh, it's so hard to tell these days, I think, Sloan. Somehow it's mysterious to people. Yeah. Even though he wants to marry her.
Yeah.
I did feel like I wanted justice for Ferris's sister because, like, I just felt so sorry for her. Like, she basically, like, the movie ends and her parents are furious at her. And, like, the mom is like, she got speeding tickets and made out with, like, a junkie. And she's, like, the worst kid and I hate her. She's just awful. But Ferris is perfect. And then she, like, the sister, like, sacrifices her own reputation for Ferris. And we don't see her get any, like, justice. Just like, well, they still hate her. Everything still sucks for that sister.
Yeah, some kind of scene where she fixes it or Ferris fixes it.
Yeah.
Something like that. You also, I realized that you could do a bonus scene, because when I was watching it, when Jeannie leaves the police station, leaves behind Garth Volbeck, which is Charlie Sheen, I don't see them trade phone numbers or anything. Just some kind of scene where she's home and she's like, wait, what do I? No. Like, you know.
It's probably better for her that she doesn't get tangled up in that Garth Volbeck nest.
Yeah. You can't break away from a Volbeck.
Nope. So you watched the movie? Here's where we're talking about some, like, kind of weird, non-intuitive arguments about things in the movie. Kind of what we sort of in-house like to refer to as our cracked observations. It's kind of things we tend to talk about on the website. We're calling this segment "Let's Overthink It." Yeah. Obviously, Katie's.
I already
the
did
best
it.
One. Ferris. Yeah. It's
already overthink it.
You overthought the shit out of this. That ties into what I think was an After Hours, but I'm not positive. Something we've done before that argues that Ferris and Sloane are figments of Cameron's imagination.
Yeah, I'd buy that.
Because it's like, you know, Ferris is an impossibly popular student, does whatever he wants, gets away with it every single time. It's just, it's like his Tyler Durden. It's him fantasizing about all the things he wishes he could do.
Right.
Because he's so lonely and depressed and under the thumb of his father.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because without them, his life would be just The Graduate, but like kind of sadder. It would just be Dustin, and no romance with a mom or anything. Like
The
just
Graduate,
Dustin
but sadder.
Hoffman. I know, right? just realizing, wow. Just like Dustin Hoffman wandering around being told plastics are the future and not thinking they're the future, and that'd be it. Like, it'd be awful. Mm.
Also, Ferris's absence is excused. Like, his parents called Rooney and were like, oh, yeah. Or like, rather, Rooney calls his parents.
Oh, yeah, like, it's fine.
Yeah, his mom said, oh, well, he's home. Sorry, I forgot to call you, but he's out today for being sick. So there's not a damn thing Rooney can do about it, even if he did find him at a pizza place.
Because also now the computer says he's only been out like 2 days. And
yeah.
That's allowed.
I suppose he could like call Ferris's parents and be like, oh, I saw your son at a pizza parlor. You think he's supposed to be there? But like outside of that, there's nothing he can do because his absence has been excused by his parents. Like that's where his power as a school administrator ends.
Right. And what did he think he was going to say to them after he breaks into their house and finds Ferris like not throwing up? He's like, well, you see, after I broke into your house, I found Ferris and he was fine.
After I bludgeoned your dog.
I hit your dog with a vase of flowers for your sick son.
I beat your dog into unconsciousness.
Yeah, that's just like this like straight up animal cruelty being portrayed in the movie for laughs.
Well, also with a lot of theories of the movie, I think other places possibly cracked, I don't remember, have talked about how the timeline of the day doesn't make sense, especially like what time of year this day is, because Ferris says it's a couple months till graduation, so it's likely like March or April or something like that. And then also the Cubs game they're at is two different days that are not March or April. The game where we see them, like when they're sitting in the stands, is a game they've figured it out. It's September 24th, 1985. And then the game is also on a restaurant TV when Rooney is in a restaurant. And the game on the restaurant TV is June 5th, 1985. And then on top of all that, the Von Steuben Day Parade, which is a big German-American holiday in Chicago and New York and elsewhere, always happens in September. So this day is in like four different parts of the year all at once. So it lends credence to it being imaginary or Jesus or something like that.
Jesus can do what he wants.
Jesus is a time lord. That's it. That's really interesting.
Through the Lord, all things are possible, especially baseball and German parades and graduations. All
that he somehow, for some reason, needed a microphone to lip sync to.
Yeah.
Like if it was just lip syncing, why was there a microphone on that float?
It's the kind of thing where I feel like if this movie was differently cast and Ferris was played by an actor with like musical theater chops or something, he would have like performed. But instead, he's just lip syncing.
Yeah.
With a microphone.
It's so weird.
It's really odd.
Particularly Donkashane.
Yeah.
Doesn't he sing in the producer? Like I thought he was on Broadway. He does sing, right?
Yeah, he sings in The Producers.
But... Oh, right. He does have musical theater chops.
But that was, I don't know if he had it at this time. Maybe it was, maybe he didn't develop that until years later. But
yeah, he does do musicals. Hang on.
He does not sing in The Lion King, though. He doesn't sing his... Actually, I don't know if he even has any songs. Oh, yeah, he does in The Lion King.
Yeah.
But Broderick doesn't sing them. Okay. I want to thank Alex and Katie so much, you guys, for doing the show today.
This was a blast.
Yeah. It's really fun having you guys on. Katie, where can we find you online?
I've got a couple of tweeters. One is Katie Golden, and the other one is Pro Bird Writes.
That's right.
That's Goldin.
Thank you, Adam.
And also, Pro Bird Rice is amazing.
That's not how you spell bird.
B-I-R-B.
Yeah, that's how you spell bird, yeah.
Burp. Alex, where can we find you online?
Oh, I'm on Cracked, and then at Alex Schmitty on Twitter.
Cool. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Cracked Movie Plot. And you can find us...
Pod, P-O-D.
Plod. Please hit us up with your thoughts, people. We've been Alex, Katie, and Tom. Thank you guys so much for listening. And join us next week for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I think, right?
Yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's going to be our...
filthy animals.
That's later.
Oh, no.
All right, that's it. Watch on, movie people. Hey, everybody. The team behind Hardcore Game of Thrones, Alex Berg, Jason Green, and Mike Hughes, is back for a brand new show on Stitcher Premium. It's called Braids. And it's a psychedelic trip through the latest developments in science, blended with lush soundscapes designed to blow your mind. Basically, imagine Radiolab on drugs. If you think you understand your consciousness or your universe, or ever wonder about what AI might be capable of in a few years, you don't know the half of it. And neither does anybody else. So get a good set of headphones, a comfortable couch, and get ready to have your reality permanently warped. Listen to a new episode of Braids every Wednesday on Stitcher Premium. For a free month trial, go to stitcherpremium.com/braids and use offer code MOVIE. That's stitcherpremium.com/braids and offer code MOVIE.
Hi, I'm Lauren Lapkus.
And I'm John Gabris.
And we have a new podcast, Raised by TV, where we're revisiting all of our old favorite TV shows from the 80s and 90s.
We're talking Full House, Saved by the Bell, Ren and Stimpy, The Real World, Singled Out, all the crap you could imagine.
And we'll sing our favorite theme songs.
Unfortunately.
And we'll eat really unhealthy snacks and basically relive our childhoods.
Check out Raised by TV right now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Or if this is my mom listening, give up. You're never going to figure it out.
This has been an Earwolf production. Executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.